Good morning. It's good to see everyone out this morning. I want to welcome you, whether you're joining us here or joining us on Facebook. Hope you've had a good week. We've got Bruce and Carol here. It's good to see them. Somebody said, oh, we got two preachers. And I said, who else is here? They're like, you're the second preacher. Oh, well, do I really count? I don't know. I don't know that. We've been going through this series. I don't know if we could call it enjoyable. I think it's an important topic to talk about, this idea of death. And it's important as we wrap up this series today that we think about it just one more time. I think it's appropriate for us to reflect on that every religion, that no matter what they are or where they are or even where they've existed on the timeline of events, almost every religion has a philosophy or ideas about what happens to a person's spirit after they die. That their body dies, but something happens to their spirit. So almost every religious group has a way of thinking about life after death. And a lot of non-religious people have philosophies about what happens after death. We've all seen movies or TV shows that are about life after death and what happens after the body dies and what happens to the spirit. Again, every religious group and almost every non-religious people have a certain idea about what happens when a person dies. And of course, as Christians, we believe that when a person dies who belongs to the Lord, that their spirit goes to be with the Lord, and that according to Revelation, that they rest from their labors. But there are two beliefs that make Christians truly unique, especially these two beliefs together. The first one is what we believe about Jesus. We are very unique in what we believe about Jesus, that Jesus is the crucified, risen Lord of Lords and King of Kings and rules over heaven and earth. So what we believe about Jesus and what we believe about death as well, because the Christian belief is unique in what we also believe about death. Again, almost every religion believes that something happens after we die, or that something happens to the spirit after a person dies. They believe that the spirit lives on in some form or in some way or in some place. But most religious people and most non-religious people believe once a person dies that their body remains dead, that their body will always remain dead, that death has won over their bodily existence. But Christians, we do not believe that. We do not believe that death wins over our bodily existence. We don't believe that death has the final word. We believe that death loses and that God wins. But as we think about resurrection and getting a new body and having a bodily existence forever, I think some of us get a little bit nervous about that, because our pain and our struggle and our suffering is so tied to our bodily existence. Every one of us, in big ways or in small ways, has frustrating things about our bodies. Our bodies get tired, they get sick, they ache, they groan, and eventually they die, right? So sometimes we think, well, a disembodied existence doesn't sound that bad to me. I might want a disembodied existence. But the gospel gives us hope that there won't be a disembodied existence, that there will be an embodied existence, and that is good, and that will always be good, and that the pain and the suffering and the death do not get to have the final word on our bodily existence. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 2. Here in this text, Paul compares our current body with a tent. He says, "For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life."
And that phrase, it should remind us of the first sermon in this series about what Isaiah said in Isaiah chapter 25 that tells us that one day God will swallow up death forever. And Paul says that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. But he compares our current body with a tent. And of course, if you've ever been tent camping, you know it's kind of terrible. And if you've ever been tent camping and the weather isn't perfect, then it really is terrible. But you're in this tent and the wind starts to blow and the tent is going crazy. Maybe a peg or two has come up and the flaps are flapping. Maybe the tent is leaking and you're asking yourselves a whole lot of questions. What was I thinking? I have a house. Why am I doing this? You're frustrated. You're groaning. You're unhappy. And Paul says that's what it's like right now in these bodies. And we can relate to that because so often our bodies hurt and they groan. And there's so much pain and frustration that is attached to these bodies. But what happens when you're in a tent and you're groaning and you're frustrated and you're angry and you're saying this is miserable, what you wish is that you wish you didn't have a tent. I mean, you're glad you have a tent, but what you really wish is that your tent could somehow become a permanent home. You don't wish that you didn't have a tent. You don't wish that you were just outside in the rain. And Paul says you don't wish to be naked or unclothed. You want your tent not to be a tent anymore. You want your tent to be a permanent structure. That's what Paul is saying. Paul is saying we don't wish to be disembodied spirits. The problem is that we don't have a body. The problem is that our body is so very frail and broken. Our bodies are so very mortal. And that's the problem because from the moment that we're born, our bodies reveal themselves to be mortal. They reveal themselves to have struggles and pain and sorrows attached to them, and eventually they wear out and they die. You might even say, for beginning from the moment that we are born, we begin to die. And so the Christian hope is not to not die, but to be done dying. Our frustration and our desire are not to have a tent. Our desire is to have a better body, to have a body that doesn't get sick, or a body that doesn't frustrate us, or that doesn't get a disease, or doesn't have broken bones. Our desire is not to be bodiless, but to have a better body. Listen to the way the New Living Translation puts 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 2 through 4. This is the same passage. It says, "We grow weary in our present bodies, and we long to put on our heavenly bodies like new clothing. For we will put on heavenly bodies, we will not be spirits without bodies. While we live in these earthly bodies, we groan and sigh, but it's not that we want to die and get rid of these bodies that clothe us. Rather, we want to put on our new bodies so that these dying bodies will be swallowed up by life." And I'm afraid sometimes we get that backwards a little bit. We suffer and we hurt and we have these pains that are attached to these bodies, and we think the goal is to just die and to be done with these bodies, but Paul says no. He says our goal isn't to be naked, unclothed spirits without bodies. Our goal isn't to die. Our goal is to be done dying, to receive better bodies, a body that won't get sick or hurt or die. And that's what eventually we will receive in the resurrection. That's what happened to Jesus. And what happened to Jesus will happen to his people, that we will have a permanent body that won't get sick or hurt or die. Now, in Paul's first letter to the church at Corinth, he deals with this idea of resurrection at length. In fact, in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, it is all about this one question. 1 Corinthians 15:12 says, "Now if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead?" Now, there were some people in Corinth that were asking this question or were coming to the conclusion that there wasn't going to be a coming resurrection, that there wasn't going to be a day in which all of God's people would be raised from the dead. Literally, their bodies brought up from the dead and transformed into immortal and imperishable bodies. There were some people in Corinth that said that wasn't going to happen. That's preposterous. Well, we don't believe in that. And for Paul, this was a huge deal. In fact, for Paul, that for them to say there wasn't a coming resurrection was the same as saying that Jesus hadn't been raised from the dead. It was the same as denying the faith. For Paul, it was a huge deal because our hope hinges on this point. Everything hinges on this hope. This hope that when Jesus comes, our bodies will be raised and transformed into immortal and imperishable bodies, never to get sick or to get hurt and never to die. Verse 20 of 1 Corinthians 15 says, "But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. But each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, and then at his coming, those who belong to Christ." And again, then at his coming, those who belong to Christ. He says Jesus has been raised from the dead. In fact, when Paul wrote this letter, there were still hundreds of people that were still alive that could testify to the fact that Jesus came out of the tomb. Not that Jesus' spirit just lived on after he died. Of course, Jesus' spirit lived on after he died, but that Jesus' body was raised from the dead. And Paul says there are hundreds of people still alive that can testify to that, and to that this is what happened to Jesus is going to happen to his people, that the rest of his people will be the rest of the harvest. Jesus was just the first one. He was the first fruits of what's to come, and what has happened to Jesus in that God has raised his body from the dead to be immortal and imperishable, what has happened to Jesus is going to happen to his people at his coming. When he comes, this is what you can expect. He says in verse 24, "Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death." That's a great phrase that Paul uses. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. God wins, death loses. Imagine that I were to tell you a story and say that there was this beautiful princess and she was captured by a horrible dragon, and this horrible dragon locked her away in a tower, and this brave knight came and he worked his way up to the tower and he found the princess. The end. That's a pretty terrible story. You can't end a story there. He found the princess. That's good. What happened next? Tell us about how he rescued her from the tower. Tell us about how he undid what the dragon had done to her. Tell us that he slayed the dragon. Tell us how they lived happily ever after. Tell us the rest of the story. So often I feel like we end the story when somebody dies as if that's the end of the story. But that's not the gospel end. That's not the Christian end. When someone dies, yes, their spirit goes to be with the Lord. Yes, they go and rest from their labors. That's true, but that's not the end of the story. Death loses, and God wins. God will raise us from the dead. God will defeat death. Death will die, and its work will be undone. Tell me that story. Tell me how my loved ones are going to come back to life, how God is going to defeat death on their behalf, how death itself on the final day will be destroyed. That's the good news story, that God wins and death loses, and the awful work that death has done is going to be undone. Look at verse 35, because one of the questions we all want to know is if this is true and God will put our bodies back together and transform them and raise them so that they are immortal and perishable, tell me what that's going to be like. What's a resurrected body like? We all want to know that answer. I don't think there's anything wrong with asking that question, but the people in Corinth were asking that question not because they were curious, but because they had already concluded that there wasn't going to be any resurrection. They couldn't imagine what that was going to be like. How could that possibly work? What exactly is that body going to be like? And so because they couldn't understand or imagine what a resurrected body would be, they concluded that it just wasn't going to happen. And so Paul says in verse 35 that someone will ask, how are the dead raised? With what kinds of body do they come? "You foolish person, what you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain." Again, they're not asking these questions out of curiosity. They're asking these questions scoffingly, scoffing at the idea of the resurrection. Paul says, listen, here's all you need to know. Our resurrected bodies are going to be different as a seed is to that which it grows. And you can picture that. You plant a seed in the ground and what springs forth is totally different, but it still came from that small seed. We don't get new bodies when we die. Our old bodies become new bodies when we are resurrected. When Jesus raises us from the dead and destroys death forever, we become something different and new, something wonderfully different that we can't even imagine, because again, our pains and frustrations and sufferings are tied so closely with our own mortality and the mortality to the people that we love. Paul says that when Jesus comes, everything will be changed. Our bodies will be changed. Look at verse 42. He says, "So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body." These bodies that we have, our current bodies right now, are the product of natural reproduction. And we've been reproducing ourselves ever since Adam and Eve. And what was Adam made of? Like dirt, right? There's nothing more natural than dirt. We're all just reproduced mud people, and it shows sometimes, doesn't it? Because we're so very mortal. We're so very weak. But Paul says our new bodies, our resurrected bodies, aren't going to be frail like that. That they're not going to be natural bodies that are the product of natural reproduction. They're supernatural bodies. That they're spiritual bodies. They are empowered by and animated by the Spirit of God. That they are not from earth. They are from heaven. That's the kind of new resurrection body that we will have. All of the weaknesses, all of the mortality, all of the hurt, all of these natural bodies that we experience in our natural bodies will be gone. Verse 53 says, "For this perishable body must be put on the imperishable, and this mortal body must put on immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written," Isaiah 25, "Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting?" And again, these are words of mocking. They're mocking death. They're saying because of Jesus, we can look at death and we can say, "Where's your power now? Or where's your sting at now? Jesus has robbed you of your power. And Jesus has robbed you of your sting." And then yes, I don't think any of us in here today like death. And death is still a reality in which we must deal. But because of Jesus, we can say, "Where's your sting at now? Where's your power at now? Jesus has robbed you of those things." Verse 56 again says, the sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. The sting of death is sin. Sin only has a claim on us. Sin only has a hold on us when we were sinners. But now, because of Jesus, we're more than that. But because of Jesus, we are forgiven. We are redeemed, we are sanctified, we are made holy, and now death has no more sting for us, no more power over us. Yes, death can interrupt our work, but it cannot overcome our work in the Lord. Death interrupts us, and it does so far too often. It interrupts us, but Paul says, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, because your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Death can interrupt our work, but it cannot overcome our work in the Lord. In the Lord, your labor is not in vain. In the Lord, death has been robbed of its sting and power. In the Lord, death has been robbed of its victory, and there's coming a day when death itself will be swallowed up. Death will be destroyed. When God's people, body, soul, spirit, all of it, that you were raised from the dead and you are transformed, become immortal and imperishable, so that you know that death can interrupt our work, but it cannot overcome our work in the Lord. Again, death loses and God wins. The victory, the end is already assured. One last verse that I want to end with. Paul says to the church in Thessalonica, as he's talking about resurrection, he says to them, "We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that they may grieve, but we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope." We often encourage each other with these, and it's appropriate for us to do so with these words. We encourage each other one-on-one. We encourage each other at funerals and memorials not to grieve as those who have no hope, but notice the difference. Notice the difference between believers and non-believers and how they grieve. It isn't how much or how little sadness they have. It certainly isn't that believers grieve with less sadness, because that's not true, is it? We grieve with just as much sadness. It's that we grieve with more hope. We don't grieve with less sadness. We grieve with more hope. We just have as much sadness as anyone else in the world. Death hurts us just as much as it hurts anyone in the world. We hate death just as much as anyone in the world. It isn't that we are less sad when someone dies. It's just that we have more hope. So grieve with as much sadness as you need to grieve with, but also have as much hope in knowing that Christ is coming, and what is to come that he brings is so much greater, because hope is the only way that we can truly cope. And when we say hope, again, we're not talking about wishful thinking. We're talking about confident expectation. We know what happened to Jesus. We know that God raised him from the dead, and we know exactly that's what's going to happen to Jesus' people. We know that God will raise us from the dead, that he will transform us, that we will have brand new resurrected bodies that are immortal and imperishable, undefiled, and that we'll be together with him forever. We know this. Well, we know that's what the future holds, and so the only way we can cope is to have hope. We don't cope by minimizing the pain of the present, but by maximizing God's promise of the future. But sometimes we get that backwards, don't we? Sometimes we're going through a painful moment, and we try to minimize the pain of the present, and we say, well, it's not that bad, or we look for that silver lining, or we try to make the present not seem so painful. But that's not what hope does. Hope doesn't minimize the pain of the present. It maximizes the promises of God's future. It maximizes what God has promised to do. We endure the present in light of the future. We deal with the things that are going on right now in hope of the future. The pain and the hurt and the suffering and the groaning right now, not because it's easy, not because it's not so bad, not because it has a silver lining. We deal with it because we know what the future holds. We know that the way things are not the way things are always going to be. And so we cope by hope, not just with grief. Maybe there are some here this morning that are grieving the loss of a loved one, or lost opportunities, or lost situations, or closed doorways that we thought were always going to be open, and they weren't. Maybe we're grieving lost dreams, or all of us are grieving some sort of thing in our life. Maybe it's just suffering. Maybe we're all struggling, dealing with temptation, or maybe we're frustrated or angry or sad in some ways. Again, hope is the only way we can cope. It's the only way we can get through these things. It's the only way we can deal with these things. And when we hope, when we know what the future holds, when we know that death will be defeated, that God wins and death loses, when we know that this for sure is going to happen, it fills us with joy. And we can deal with sadness differently when we hope. We can deal with grief differently when we hope. We can deal with temptation differently when we hope. We can deal with pain and sorrow and sadness and frustration differently, again, when we hope, because we know for a fact that the way things are not the way things are always going to be. This is the life in which we are stepping into when we're baptized into Jesus. When we're baptized into Jesus, we're not baptized into a life with no more pain. We're not baptized into an easy life that minimizes pain. We are baptized into a life of hope, resurrected from the water to walk in a newness of life with our hope and our eyes set on Jesus and on the future that Jesus promises. Of course, along the way, well, we suffer and we struggle and we groan in these mortal bodies, and it can be difficult. And so we encourage each other not to grieve as those who have no hope, but to hope in the Lord. And hope is that only way that we can truly cope. So if you're struggling to cope, and we can help you and put your hope in Jesus and to focus your future that he's promised us, or maybe there's someone here this morning and you're needing to put Jesus on into baptism. If we can help you in any way, talk to one of our elders or our deacons or myself, or come now as together we stand and we sing.